Welcome
Hello?
To episode 10 of the 2017 Fresh Bread Podcast. This week, I am joined by my usual co-host, Tom Bowles, along with recurring guest, Danny Peters, who is here to help us break down a wild weekend from Talladega. But first, I want to talk to you guys about DraftKings. Even though the NASCAR regular season is now nearing its halfway point, you still have plenty of time to jump in on the action with DraftKings. On DraftKings, the objective is simple. Pick six drivers, watch how they perform on Sundays, and if you pick correctly, you can be eligible for massive cash prizes. All you have to do to jump in on the action is to sign up for the DraftKings link on the Front Stretch Podcast article page, make a $5 deposit, and then you'll be eligible for a free entry into one of this weekend's contests for Kansas. Once again, DraftKings.com, where you choose, you play, you win. Gentlemen, I thank both of you for joining me on this fine Wednesday night with a Thursday run date for the podcast for those listening at home. I want to talk to you guys a little bit about Talladega, a wild weekend for sure. Probably one of the most successful weekends of the NASCAR season, I think, from a number of different metrics, whether it's on the competitive side of the sport, from the attendance perspective. Tom, we'll start with you. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the race itself first before we kind of get into some of the attendance stuff. What made this particular race at Talladega so impactful, so memorable? You know, JeffBlock.com, the crowdsourcing poll rated this the best super speedway race of the past 3 years. What made this particular Talladega race so special?
Well, I think you have to start with a first-time winner. Anytime you have a first-time winner, like you had with Ricky Stenhouse Jr., there adds a little extra level of excitement to the race itself. You know, the first guy from Mississippi to win a race in 30 years. So he's a local bred guy. I know Mississippi is the state next to Alabama, but still a Southeast guy. And the way he got to it, putting himself in position to win and then charging to the front in a frenetic last lap, which the move Jamie McMurray made, let's just say that. I mean, Danny, that has to be maybe the best restrictor plate move of all time that didn't result in a victory. I just can't believe he was able to do that and not wreck. That was just absolutely incredible.
I think the best restrictor plate move I've seen of all time that didn't lead to victory was Earnhardt Jr. in the 2010 Daytona 500. It was actually a very similar move. Do you guys remember this one? It's 2010 500. It was actually the race McMurray won, where Jr., he went from like 10th to 2nd in the last lap. And he just shot up the middle just like McMurray did. It actually was very reminiscent. But continue, please.
Yeah, I mean, it was just incredible. And you saw him thread the needle and you're like, oh my goodness, how is he not going to win? But I was really impressed with the ability of Stenhouse to hold him off. And I think the other thing that you need to look at, because obviously you could say for every restrictor plate race, yeah, the last lap was incredible. The last lap was incredible. I feel like 40 to 50% of the time in these races. But as a whole, even though there were only 26 lead changes, you had a constant shuffling of guys in front of the field. And you had a lot of big names, big veteran names like Earnhardt in contention late in the game, compared to, you know, some young guys that were up near the front of the field. You know, Ryan Blaney spent some time at or near the front of the field until he wrecks. You know, Chase Elliott was at or near the front of the field until he gets flipped over. You saw the Toyotas up front for a while. The Fords took their time up front. And Danny, I just thought it was not just parity. We have parity in every restrictor plate race. That's what the plates are for. But I really thought all three manufacturers were strong, and it was anybody's race for a really long time throughout the 500 miles.
Yeah, you know, I absolutely agree with that. And that I think is the beauty of restrictor plate races, is that it can be anyone's race pretty much right up until the last corner. And, you know, you talk about Jamie McMurray and the move that he made. You know, let's not forget that four of his seven career victories have come at restrictor plate tracks, two at Daytona, including the 500, and two at Talladega. So seeing him do amazing things on super speedways is kind of not a surprise, I'd say. And it's kind of what you expect from him. But, you know, for me, it's that one of the four races of the year where every lap you kind of feel like you have to pay attention. You know, when we go to some other tracks, maybe some middle laps in the race, you can kind of tune out a little bit. But there's something very, I think the word I would use is mesmeric about the restrictor plate races. You just can't take your eyes off them. And for NASCAR, that's got to be a good thing.
Can I say something real quick about McMurray before I know Matt jumps in? Because this season we've had to talk so much about stuff going on outside the racetrack. We usually don't get this deep in analysis. But how impressive was that interview after the race? And it shows you how strong Chip Ganassi Racing is right now, where usually McMurray, this is his only shot to get the victory the whole season. Daytona and Talladega, that's how far behind they've been. And they've had to focus on more consistency just to make the playoffs. Well, you interview him after the race, he's cool as a cucumber, and he's like, you know what? I just wanted to survive Talladega because I feel like we can win everywhere else. So I just wanted the points for this because we're having a really strong season. I think that speaks volumes about CGR because McMurray's not the type of guy to brag. McMurray's the type of guy to just, you know, take what he can get and move on. And I thought that the strength of his comments was really important as to the direction that CGR is going and just the feel-good vibes that everybody has over there right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll tell you what, I think that actually dovetails pretty well with the next topic that I want to get into, but I'll kind of give you guys my thoughts on the weekend. I thought the stages made quite an impact on Sunday in terms of that race. I think stage racing on a super speedway just seems like the perfect marriage. I think 55, you know, 78, 50 was 55, 55, 78 in terms of the stage breakdown. And man, like those three kind of, you know, lap, you know, amounts, so to speak, just felt perfect for the race. I mean, every stage felt like it was its own individual race. There was an urgency the entire race long. I think the fact that, you know, the big one didn't happen until very late in the race kind of added an urgency to the race as well. You kind of just never knew when that was coming. And not that anyone's rooting for Rex, but, you know, it did kind of put you on that edge of the seat because it was such a crazy pack the entire race. I haven't seen a race at Talladega that was driven that hard in, my God, it's been at least a decade since I've seen a race at Talladega like that. And it, to me, the entire race, and this is more of an esoteric statement, but the whole race just felt old school to me. Throw the stages out for a minute, but the race itself just had that feel of an old school race. You had comers and goers. You had, you know, young guys mixing it up with, you know, some of the older guard, and just kind of the feel of that Talladega race just reminded me so much of some of the Talladega races that I grew up with. You know, we ended up with a surprise winner, you know, late race. It just felt old school. It reminded me a little bit of like the 2002 Aaron's 499, which was, you know, probably only the third or fourth Talladega race that I ever saw. And it was a very similar race, just hard driven the entire time. A late wreck, a scramble at the finish. It just had that feel to it, a very old school feel. And the conversation around the race, it just seemed very, very positive. It just seemed like there was quite a bit of buzz around the race this year. So, you know, it's clear to me that Talladega is doing a lot of things right. And I want to kind of get into that topic here first. But any final thoughts on the racing itself before we get into the next topic, which does relate to Talladega, has to do with Kyle Busch. But any final thoughts on the race itself on Sunday?
Well, I think one thing that helped NASCAR, and it's as much as I hate to say it, because I think the restrictor plates are a constant topic of conversation, right? Because of the safety issues of the big wrecks and the fact that NASCAR promised them as a temporary solution 30 years ago and still won't commit to them as a permanent solution. You know, you have the big wreck, and in the past, you've had drivers that were openly critical about plate racing and just saying, this is ridiculous, and really turning the tables on the narrative after the race. Well, a lot of those drivers are now retired. And one thing I found really interesting is after the big wreck, everybody was getting out of the cars and saying, you know what? It was a great race. It was plate racing. It's just the way it is. They weren't saying it in a really negative way. They weren't creating those negative storylines. And I think that helped the sport coming out of Talladega, because this is the first time in a long time, Danny, that I can remember that we're not talking about the safety of plate racing. But I mean, in turning it to you, I know plate racing has always been your favorite style of racing, even when you were just a fan and not riding at all. Do you feel like this lived up to the billing for you? Were you on the edge of your seat the whole time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely on the edge of my seat. And I normally judge it by my dog when I'm watching sport. If my dog when I'm watching, say, Premier League soccer, my beloved Arsenal, my dog will run out of the room when we start losing and I'm swearing at the TV. And I was all hyped up for the race this weekend, and my dog ran out midway through second stage and she didn't come back the rest of the race. So that's a sign to me that it was definitely a good race. The one guy I'd just give a quick shout out to is, you know, one of the little guys, David Reagan. You know, he gets a top 10, and that's his first top 10 in 85 races all the way back to Martinsville in early 2015. So, you know, only his 37th top 10 result in 372 races across 12 years. But, you know, little victories. And, you know, I always like to highlight when a smaller team gets a good result, and obviously plate tracks are a place where they can do that. So good job to the veteran, I suppose we should call him now, David Reagan. So first top 10 in a long time.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You know, I think Reagan, it's good for that team to kind of build some momentum there. So that's definitely a good point on that. And Tom, just to kind of wrap up on your point, that's a really an interesting and under-discussed topic, I think, is the fact that a lot of the younger drivers who are coming up, and this is something that I had predicted a little bit, you know, Chase Elliott, Ryan Blaney, Austin Dillon, those three specifically have all gone actually on record saying that they enjoy plate racing. Blaney has actually been pretty outspoken about it. I specifically remember after this very race last year, which attracted a lot of controversy from some of the veteran drivers, Kenseth, and a few others, Tony Stewart. Blaney actually made a point to tweet, hey, I like super speedway racing. Like, no complaints here. I know what I'm getting into, so to speak, that sort of rhetoric. And I think you're just going to see that continue as, you know, these younger drivers come in. I mean, listen. A lot of times fans get very caught up in this sport because it's – auto racing is such a unique sport because the average person can go out, they can throw a football. They can go out, they can shoot a basketball. The average person really can't in any really sort of way get any real sense of what is happening at 200 miles per hour on a racetrack. You just can't. So a lot of misconceptions, I think, end up forming. You know, one driver says X, and then suddenly that becomes gospel. Right? And that was never really the case here with plate racing. You know, a lot of drivers, you know, in the past, you know, they say they didn't like it. It's not racing. Blah, 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 blah. We're going to get to that a little bit more deeper. This is actually a good segue here. But, you know, people who are my age, so Blaney, Chase Elliott, our generation grew up with restrictor plate racing. Restrictor plate racing is all we've ever known. Whereas, you know, guys, you know, like Neff's age, you know, who I know kind of come down on restrictor plates and that sort of thing. They grew up in an era where there was no restrictor plates, and Daytona and Talladega has a certain association in their minds where it wasn't restricted. And I think that extends out to the drivers. You know, guys like Tony Stewart, Jeff Gordon, Jimmy Johnson, Matt Kenseth, even Junior, like those guys, when they were growing up in the sport, they grew up in an era where they either knew about what it was like before restrictor plates, or they kind of grew up in that era where plates were kind of just coming into being.
What a good point. What a good point. And I don't mean to interrupt real quick, but you're a young millennial. I'm an old millennial. Danny's just outside it, but he wasn't a fan in the late 80s. Restrictor plates are all we've ever known. I mean, when I was 8 years old and I watched a race for the first time, the plates were on to stay.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that the younger the fan, I think, is, the less the restrictor plate, I think, has an effect on their perception. I think that they just see good racing. I think for so many years, and let's make one thing straight. I think restrictor plate racing has always been the most popular form of racing in this sport, but it's also been very polarizing over the years. And I think that's to the detriment of the sport because, as we're going to get into a little bit later in this podcast, we saw that the only two races this season that have had really meaningful increases on either the rating side or the attendance side or both have been the restrictor plate races, guys. I mean, in an era where, you know, we're seeing declines in the sport across a number of different properties within the sport, restrictor plate racing is the one constant that has held. But you get, over the years, we've had so much pushback on it from old school fans. And again, that's not saying that their views aren't valid. And I'm not even saying that the racing couldn't possibly be better without it, because I don't want to kind of go down that road. But this style of racing is really one of the few things in this sport that we have concrete evidence that it crosses over. It actually has the ability to draw in a wider audience, to retain fans that have been in this sport for a long time. They're very important races. And I think that it's good to kind of put a pin in this. It's good that the millennial drivers that are coming up grew up with that style of racing and can and respect it for what it is. Because for so many years, you know, fans like myself who grew up with this style of racing, there was a lot of cognitive dissonance, I think, for fans like me growing up, because I, on one hand, loved watching restrictor plate races growing up. It was the most exciting form of racing in NASCAR to me. And then after a race, I would have to go and listen to Tony Stewart talk about how much he didn't like doing it. So that was there was a lot of cognitive dissonance for me growing up listening to that. And, you know, I would almost feel bad for enjoying it in some regards. I don't necessarily think that's fair. It's simply its own beast. It's a different style of racing. And I think a lot of the older drivers who kind of didn't grow up with it saw it in a different light from what I think it actually kind of is. It's just a different style of racing. And I think this is a good segue for here, our second topic here. Kyle Busch obviously went on record after the race, frustrated from losing, obviously, and said, next week we're going to go to a real racetrack. I mean, I won't make any bones about it. I thought that I didn't care for that comment personally. As someone who I think wants to see this sport succeed, I think we all do. I don't think comments like that personally help this sport, but I'm certainly open to argument on that. What did you guys make of that comment from both the perspective of Kyle Busch, the person, and then what that comment meant to restrictor plate racing, as we have kind of been discussing here on this podcast?
So I'll go first on this one. Where did the question? Where did Kyle Busch finish on Sunday?
Kyle Busch finished third.
Exactly. Who led the most laps?
Kyle Busch did.
Right. And how many times have we seen Kyle Busch do a second place or third place interview? And basically, what he says is a nice version of "I'm extremely," you know, insert your own swear words. No, that's kind of what you get from him. So.
Absolutely.
So on some level, I just think it's Kyle Busch being Kyle Busch. You know, if he doesn't win, he's going to be annoyed. And that, to me, is one of his great qualities, how disappointed he is with second place, right? But in many ways, I think he's kind of completely wrong, because in many ways, it's almost the most real form of racing in some senses, because it's such a dangerous race. You know, I mean, they're on the edge every lap. We saw what happened in the big one. We saw AJ go upside down. You know, what if, you know, that could have been a lot worse, right? So in some ways, it's almost like the definition of racing in the sense that it is so dangerous and is such much-see viewing.
And the parody
as well, you know, to see everybody has a chance. And, you know, yes, everybody has a chance, but you still got to be in the position to win it at the end. And it's no surprise that you see, you know, the same drivers, you know, over and over again up there near the top of the field. But, you know, I honestly put that comment down to Kyle Busch being Kyle Busch, and it gets a little bit more publicity and people talk about it, and then it all gets forgotten, you know, and until the next time when he's going to say it again or someone else will say it again. For me, nothing really to see here. I mean, Kyle said a lot worse.
Well, here's the wild card to me, and I think we often forget about this. Who is the only driver in the last decade, basically, that has been hurt by restrictor plate racing? And I mean genuinely hurt, to the point where he spent extensive time out of the car and needed rehab and was shown the reality of how restrictor plate racing can be, in some cases, a very, very serious risk? Kyle Busch, Daytona, February 2015, you know, the broken legs and the rehab and everything he had to go through. And I think if you look at things from that perspective, I think Kyle Busch has an understanding of the dangerous side of restrictor plate racing and the dark side when things go wrong. So is that all of this? I don't think so. I agree with Danny that Kyle Busch being Kyle Busch is part of this. He's had a really bad season in terms of winning. What, one Xfinity Series win and that's it? And he's had a lot of missed opportunities at the Cup level, which is beginning to get really, really frustrating. That whole Joe Gibbs Racing operation, no wins through 10 races, as opposed to, I believe, 5 wins through 10 races last year. You know, Busch is barely hanging on to the top 10 in points. So there's a lot for him to be frustrated about. But I think he's one of the guys that's always going to preach that reality. And when you get hurt, at a certain style of racing, particularly that style where it's out of your control, I think you're going to be a little upset about it.
And let me – I don't want to take anything away from – he's got a fair point. Assuming if that is, you know, what's driving it, I don't personally think that it actually is what's driving it with him personally. But let's put that aside for a moment. Let's say that is what's driving it. That's a fair point, and I get it. You know, if I was a stock car, you know, driver, and, you know, I looked at the full schedule, I mean, I'm putting myself at risk when I race at Daytona Talladega, and my family is going to be nervous every time I race at Daytona Talladega. So I can understand why a driver wouldn't necessarily enjoy racing at those racetracks. But the comment that he made was not, I don't enjoy this track. It was, this isn't a real racetrack, implying that it is somehow lesser. It is somehow not, you know, the same skill level, whatever you want to call it. It is not on to par with the other tracks on the schedule in whichever metric that you want to use. Now, granted, this is not a new argument. Kyle Busch is certainly not the first person to say this. I highly doubt he'll be the last person to say this. But I think this underscores a bigger problem in this sport from an optics perspective to me. And I've always been personally very irritated by this because in this sport, there's a lot of people that are working hard to try and broaden the audience, bring a new audience into this. And if I'm a new person who comes into this sport and I see that interview, and that's probably going to be a very confusing interview to a new fan. And that's not something that this sport needs. And, you know, you've got enough drivers who I think, even though they may not enjoy it for some of the reasons that we mentioned, they view it as legitimate. They view that as a unique form of racing unto its own, with its own skill sets and its own kind of, you know, methods for success, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we still have these holdovers from kind of a different era who are saying things like this. And I think it hurts the sport when drivers speak about Daytona and Talladega, which are the two most important racetracks on the schedule. And it's very problematic. Now, listen, Kyle's entitled to his opinion, of course. But I don't think it's fair to these racetracks because I don't think that is the case. I think it's a silly and I think it's a myopic thing to say it's not a real racetrack. I think what I've noticed over the years is a lot of the drivers who said that at one point ended up taking those comments back once they found some consistent success. Two guys that come to mind with this are Joey Logano and Denny Hamlin. I remember specifically when Joey Logano won the 2015 Daytona 500. They asked him in victory lane. They said, "Joey, you know what changed? You know, you were outspoken about plate racing last year." And he goes, "Listen, man." He goes, "A lot of it was on me." He goes, "I wasn't doing a lot of things right in the car. The team wasn't doing a lot of things right. I wasn't taking it as seriously as I needed to." And it turned out, ever since Logano has kind of redid his perspective on plate racing, his whole mindset changed. Brad Keselowski had an article that came out this week specifically talking about the mindset that you need to race at Talladega. And I think with Kyle, guys, I hate to say it, but Kyle has not been overtly successful at the restrictor plate tracks in his career. That's been a weak point for him. He had one win at Talladega early in his career, and he has not won a restrictor plate race since that win in 2008. That's it.
I think
that's a
fair point. Fair point, but I also want to say this. God forbid if we endure another tragedy anywhere else but the restrictor plate tracks, if we endure another tragedy at, say, Charlotte, the focus is going to be on safety. The focus is going to be on, you know, what caused the crash. The focus is going to be on preventing it from happening again, subtle changes. If there is a tragedy at Daytona or Talladega, based on 30 years of this, NASCAR is playing with fire every single time. They're playing with it every single time.
I completely agree on that point. The thing is, though, I think they're too – maybe it might – listen, it might be reckless of me to say this, but I think they are two separate issues. Now, I'm not saying that the safety aspect should be ignored in any regard. I definitely don't want to create that perception. But I do think that – put it all in a vacuum for a second. And let's say that there's – in a theoretical world, restrictor plate racing is perfectly safe. okay? That becomes a separate issue. The racing itself and the legitimacy of the racing is a separate issue to me than the safety aspect of it. Safety aspect's a lot more important, but it's a separate issue. And I think as far as this Kyle Busch discussion is concerned, I think it's about, you know, the former and not the latter in terms of the safety component of it. So that's what I would say is as far as that goes. I just think it's frustrating. I think it's a problematic subject that I do think NASCAR needs to take a look at, or NASCAR at some point needs to find some sort of a happy medium that can appease the drivers so that they don't carry that perception. And I think that there are ways to do it. I think there's ways to, and this becomes a subject for a different podcast, but I think that there are absolutely ways to carry some of the pillars of plate racing and then put them into a different sort of a package. Any final thoughts?
It's all about control. I want to make sure Danny gets his shot, but to me, it's all about control. With plate racing, for years, drivers have felt like, based on the different packages, this one, I feel like, puts it in the driver's hands more than some of the other packages, but they feel like they have no control, and God forbid something happens in front of them, they're in it. And it's not Bristol, where they get caught up in something going 120 miles an hour. They get caught up in something going 190 miles an hour with 20 cars that could pile into them and with the chance they're going to flip over, like Chase Elliott on Sunday. And there's a lot to be excited about in NASCAR in 2017, a lot of positive things that are going on. But the plate stuff still is this cloud, and NASCAR has become increasingly dependent on the excitement created by these races because the racing has struggled at times everywhere else. And it's this horrible dependency that they have, where I don't think they're going to change the rules anytime soon because of what we get on Sunday and the exciting race that we had. But they're also playing with fire, and they need to be aware of that.
I think that's a fair point. Go ahead, Danny.
Two quick things I would say. You know, what do we always complain about drivers not showing personality? That's Kyle showing personality when he says stuff like that. You know, he knows what he's saying, and that's just part of him and who he is. So I'd rather he was unfiltered. I'd rather we did hear his opinion than that. That kind of leads me to my second point. I think it was you, Tom, who said, you know, if someone watches the race and they're a new person and then they see that interview with Kyle afterwards, you know, does it put them off? I would say, well, if they've watched the race, they've either enjoyed it or not enjoyed it. To me, what Kyle Busch says afterwards shouldn't affect their interest level. If anything, it should make them say, I wonder why he says that. I want to look up a bit more information on that. I'll give you for example. When I arrived in the United States, the first night I arrived was Game 7 of the 2001 World Series, which the Diamondbacks beat the Yankees, Game 7, right? And I don't know if you guys will remember this. You probably weren't born yet, Matt, but you know, the winning hit was like a little bloop single, and I remember thinking to myself, like, how do you win a game on a crappy little shot like that? And so it got me interested. It got me. I wanted to learn about it. I wanted to, you know more. You know, so if anything, if someone's watching it, they've enjoyed the race, and then they hear Kyle say that, the thinking fan would be like, well, why is he saying that? What are the reasons he's saying that? You know, where does that come from? You know, why is he being like that? So those would be my kind of two final related points on the issue.
And listen, I think the personality aspect is completely fair. You know, my thing is, and this may, I don't mean to sound like I'm towing a company line when I say this, but I try to think of things from the perspective of growing the sport, and because I think that's what the sport needs right now is growth. And I think that there's a line between personality and calling into question the legitimacy of some aspect of the sport. I think that is a line that I personally strongly believe shouldn't be crossed if you're an athlete. I don't think it helps the athlete. I don't think it helps the sport. I don't think it helps anybody. Now, showing your personality absolutely helps, but I don't think that – I think that those topics aren't mutually exclusive. You know, I think you can show your personality without having to show, you know, question the legitimacy of the sport. But, you know, I also understand that this is a broad debate too. And you know, my biggest the sport is so tied to Daytona and Talladega, right? And the fear that I always have is that if you have people that, in my opinion, are erroneously calling into question the legitimacy of an important style of racing in the sport. Because, you know, take the plates out of it. Even if you, even in a theoretical situation where they took the plates off, you would still have some form of fashion of pack racing. Anytime that the draft gets involved, you tend to get people that start questioning, oh, well, this is different from dirt racing, and this is different from road course. One of the things that's interesting is that, like, in a sport like racing, you know, the style of sport changes from week to week. And I think there's a lot of people in this sport, media, fans, even drivers, who still, to this day, for some bizarre reason, haven't been able to separate the fact that there are different styles of racing in this sport that all kind of have their own, you know, way of operating, way of kind of unfolding. And I think that in order for the whole sport to be better, we all have to respect that. Safety arguments are a completely different story, and I agree that should be addressed. But if this sport's going to grow, we can't have key stakeholders in the sport questioning something like this. But again, that's just me. So, gentlemen, I want to move forward. Last topic of the night here. I want to talk a little bit about the attendance at Talladega this past weekend. Reports are suggesting that there were over 100,000 people there on Sunday between the grandstands and the infield. It was a year-over-year increase over last year, pretty much the only attendance increase we've seen since Daytona. A good overall weekend for the sport, on the business side. I mean, everybody from NASCAR to the Speedway to the drivers, everybody sort of praised that weekend. Again, we might be being somewhat redundant here, but what do you attribute the success of Talladega versus some of these other racetracks? And what can NASCAR, more specifically, what can NASCAR learn from Talladega? And what can NASCAR learn from this, we'll call it a success story right now, because even though Talladega took some seats out a few years ago, that track has been one of the most consistent in terms of attendance. And it's been one of the more consistent ones on the TV side. What do you guys attribute some of this to? Again, maybe we covered this, but what can the sport learn from it? Tom, we'll start with you. Mr. Bowles, are you still thinking?
Sounds like he's still thinking. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, this is what happens when you put your mic on mute and you think a little too much. So this is the first race, major race, in my opinion, after the Earnhardt retirement, where people really were able to absorb it and say, oh, my goodness, we're going to have a limited number of chances to see this guy. So I think it was really, really important to gauge that one of those early races afterwards. And I think they did a great job of advertising it and getting the attendance up. And I think there were a lot of people that said, oh, you know, we really want to see one of Earnhardt's final plate races. But with that being said, I do think Matt has always had a point on the podcast about how plate races really have risen in the quality of competition in fans' eyes. You know, they are premier races. And I think in this age of social media where people are after experiences, Talladega offers an experience. The infield is an experience. Anybody that's ever been to Talladega will tell you that. You walk through the infield, it's kind of like the Kentucky Derby or some of the Triple Crown races. The Preakness is what I'm thinking of in a couple weeks. You know, the craziness that goes on in the infield. And you're guaranteed a great race. You're guaranteed a great time. Almost definitely going to that track. And Talladega does a great job of selling the experience, and that's what NASCAR can learn from. And I think some of these other racetracks, they really struggle to sell the experience. I think of Dover. You know, Dover's got a casino. Dover's got some stuff around it, but they don't do a really good job at advertising what else people can do and what the track offers over the course of the weekend. You know, Danny, what do you think? I know this is really more up your alley in terms of advertising, marketing, like, you know, getting people to the racetrack.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw first of all, I thought it was amazing. When I saw that first shot, that wide shot of the crowd, and there's like not a free seat to be had, it just made me smile. Like, of all the stories and all the times we've talked about attendance sucking, this was one day when the attendance was absolutely fantastic. So that for me is the kind of big overall headline. I think that's great. I was so happy. I do think the Dale Earnhardt Jr. retirement was a announcement was a factor, and I read somewhere, and I'm sorry that I can't recall the exact stat, but the number of tickets that they sold in the last kind of week was, I think it was like twice as much as this time, this sort of same comparable time period last year. So maybe that's what the tracks need to learn. You know, every track with a race between now and the Homestead, it should all be about Dale Earnhardt Jr. Come see Dale Earnhardt Jr. at Sonoma for the last time. Come see him at Michigan for the last time. You know, that, and that might be the message that they can give. But I mean, I really don't know that there's an awful lot that can be learned because of, you know, as we've discussed on this podcast already, the unique nature of the track. You know, it's such a unique track. It's a track that you go to where you know you're going to see a good race. You can't say that necessarily about other tracks. I mean, you can't guarantee you'll get a great race, but you can be pretty sure it's going to be pretty exciting. So maybe the lesson for NASCAR here is, you know, use Dale Earnhardt Jr. and his likeness to promote every single race between now and the end of the season. Come see the 88 for the last time. Maybe there's a special offer if you come in wearing an 88 hat, you get a free Budweiser or something, you know, something like that. But, no, it's a unique race, and it's a unique attendance situation, I think. And the Earnhardt factor was big.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to discount the junior factor. I think that was important. But with Talladega, I look at the trend the last few years, and that track on both the television side and on the track attendance side has had wins in an era where tracks aren't getting wins. And what I find so interesting is people talk, the hardest of the hardcore fans will tell you, you know, the Mike Neff, Aaron Bearden, you know, love those guys. They'll come on here and they'll tell me, they're like, Matt, we need more short tracks. We need more tracks like Darlington. We need more tracks. We need more road courses. And I think there's a fair argument there. So I'm playing devil's advocate to some extent against that. But hear me out. Why is it that we just went, and again, I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit because I already made some points on past podcasts of why I think what happened the last few weeks actually did happen at the short tracks. But just to play devil's advocate, Richmond had a half-empty arena. Martinsville had tons of empty seats. Bristol, it was a rain situation. We don't really know what would have happened there on Sunday, but the crowd wasn't appearing like it was going to be incredible. Now, I love short track racing. Don't get me wrong. Why is it that every stakeholder in this sport tries to act like short tracks are this panacea for the sport's ills, but we can't fill them? Yet, they'll deride super speedway racing, as Kyle Busch said, is not a real racetrack, so to speak. And I don't mean to speak for everybody. This is a small segment that says these things. But there's a lot of people in this sport that think that we need to go back to just more short tracks, more road courses. I understand that this is kind of an inflammatory opinion here, but why is nobody seeming to want to learn from the fact that the style of racing, and I don't mean packs per se, but draft-oriented racing, a style of racing where you can kind of guarantee that there's going to be a battle for the lead at most points of the race. That is what makes Talladega Talladega. It's what makes Daytona Daytona. That's why those tracks are what they are. That's a key pillar in why those tracks have such an incredible atmosphere there, because the fans are so excited about the race that ends up carrying over to the party atmosphere. It ends up kind of creating an aura. It's all interconnected. And the question, you know, fans talk about, we got to get rid of Michigan. We should get rid of Auto Club. We should get rid of Pocono. We should get rid of Indy. Those are the tracks that I think NASCAR needs to be taking the biggest look at. What can we do with those racetracks to create something similar? I don't say pack racing per se. How can we take the success of Talladega on the racetrack and carry that over to other places? I think that is kind of where I think there's a lot of people that don't want to admit the fact in this sport that if you really want to attract a broad audience in this sport, if you want to create a more engaged fan base, you got to figure out some way to get drafting involved at these racetracks that aren't short tracks or road courses. The short tracks and road courses are exciting for their own reasons. But, you know, people ask, like, what can you do to spice up the mid-sized tracks? And, I, you know, people come on this podcast and we talk about tire wear. They'll talk about Arrow. They'll talk about all of these different things. And to be honest with you, the answer seems to be pretty clear, guys, as to what keeps fans engaged. I mean, we saw it this past weekend. I mean, what other racetrack do you go to where a lead change of any between any two drivers is going to get fans on their feet and screaming in the grandstands like it is at Talladega? You don't get that anywhere else. And, you know, I go back to what's happening with Indianapolis this summer with the Xfinity test. They're trying a super speedway-esque package with plates. They're trying things with a draft there. And I've seen so many people who are just like, oh, they shouldn't try that. That's not going to be worth it. That's not going to lead to good racing. Why not try it? Indy is one of the few tracks where you could actually create something like that. Why is there such a perception in the sport that we have to avoid that, especially when there's only a few racetracks where you can really even replicate it to begin with? So it's not like it's going to take the style of racing that some of the hardcore people love about Bristol away. Why are we ignoring that? This has been something that's always frustrated me for my years of watching. I don't want to imply that we need to have a restricted plate race every week. That's not what I'm saying. But there's aspects of that style of racing that clearly engage people, and we're ignoring them. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think you make an interesting point, and anything NASCAR can do to kind of learn from what's a success and use it elsewhere can only help. But to me, your bigger problems really are ticket prices and hotel gouging. You know, those are your two really big factors, because, you know, if you're talking about
that.
You know, if you're talking about $80, $100 a ticket, $300 room, hotel room night, you know, people can't afford that. Yeah, I mean, you know, I know NASCAR has fans from, you know, from poor to super rich, right? Across that full spectrum, I think, is something that doesn't get talked about very much at times. But, you know, right now, I think people are just priced out of going to NASCAR. And, you know, Denny Hamlin said something about it at Richmond. You know, you've got people driving down the highway watching the race on Twitter. You know, that's not actually driving, but, you know, being driven in their car. You know, you've got so many options to watch a race. When you add on top of that, well, you're going to have, if you're looking a family of four to a race, call it one or two nights hotel room. You know, you could be talking $1,500, $2,000, like, without even trying. You know, how many people have that kind of level of disposable income? So I think until NASCAR can address those two problems, I think we'll continue to see more of the same. You know, I've long been an advocate for let kids in for free. You know, get, if you're under 15, you get in for free. You know, that's, I think, where NASCAR is gonna bring back more fans and gonna generate some more excitement, rather than sort of trying to do something with restrictor plates at certain tracks. I'm not discounting your idea, because I think your idea is a good one, and, you know, and a sensible one. But to me, it's kind of a smaller issue compared to some of the bigger problems that the tracks have around, you know, hotel costs and ticket prices.
Tom,
Tom's thinking
again. Darn mute button again. This is the first time I'm using it, and also the last time for this podcast. So, you know, I bit by it twice in one podcast. So what I'm thinking is, while your ideas are solid, I think there needs to be a mix between what you're doing in terms of keeping the old school and also keeping the new school. And, you know, depending on what you do, I think that you can have a mix of both, but I think you can't get too radical. There have been so many changes in the last 13 years since the advent of the Chase. How many more changes can people stomach?
Well,
and I think that's something I think about a lot.
The one comment I will say to that, and again, some of this comes down to the fact that it's hard to get anyone's vision as they have it in their brain completely conveyed out on paper or over the airwaves, right? But, you know, people have complained for years. Old school fans have complained for years about the racing at places like Michigan, Indy, Pocono, some of these bigger tracks. I'm not really going to throw the mile and a half in there because, again, there's just too many of them. And to bring a style of racing that radical over to all those tracks, I think would be a tough sell. But I personally think that if you could somehow take elements, I'm not saying a 3-deep by 10-row pack, not necessarily what I'm saying, but if you could take elements of super speedway racing, maybe like mini packs of 5 and 10 cars that are battling, close racing, drafting, if you could take elements of that and bring it to places like Auto Club, Michigan, and Indianapolis, there's three or four racetracks that could benefit from it, and I think that you could do it without oversaturating the market. It creates something that really is wholly different and bring a new style of racing at tracks, which, guys, I'm sorry. Michigan is – I like Michigan. It's a great racetrack. I like watching races there, but I'm also not the average fan. I can watch a race from pretty much any racetrack under any competitive conditions and probably enjoy it, okay? But I'm trying to speak for the person that might be trying to commit to the sport. And I think, you know, if you bring that style of racing 6 or 7 times a year versus 4, it kind of spreads out that excitement, because if you're exposing that style of racing that many times a year, and let's say that style of racing is like a gateway drug for NASCAR, I don't think that gateway drug is being used enough. I think that gateway drug needs to be used a little bit more. Is I think maybe the bigger point here. You know, we don't need to turn every race into a draft fest. But if you increase, you know, the frequency of that style of racing, I think you're going to get more people that maybe would enjoy a race at Vegas because they got exposed to NASCAR because of, you know, a crazier, more draft-oriented race at a place like an auto club or in Indianapolis. So a wild idea, something I wanted to pitch to you guys, but I enjoyed the debate nonetheless. Any final thoughts on this topic before we close this thing out?
I need to be better at the mute button.
I agree with that.
I firmly agree. All right, gentlemen. Well, to finish things up here, because we're running out of time, Kansas this weekend, going back to Fox Sports 1, first night race of the season. What are you guys' expectations for this weekend's race in Kansas? 10 seconds. Tom, we'll start with you.
I think we're going to have one of the better intermediate races of the season. I think Kansas is always underrated as a 1.5-mile track. And I think you need to keep an eye on somebody like Stenhouse, believe it or not. You know, Kansas was one of his best racetracks over the last couple of years, has had some solid runs there. And also a guy like Eric Almirola that likes Kansas a lot. I think that it's one of the more unpredictable intermediates. We've seen some surprise winners there. And it really wouldn't surprise me if a middle-class guy came up and challenged for the victory, you know, and fought back against Team Penske, you know, and everything that we've seen going on there. And one more quick thing, Penske needs a little bit of a rebound. And what I mean by that is we've now seen 2 major penalties for Team Penske within the last couple of weeks that have cost them 60 points and over $100,000 in fines. We don't talk about cheating in this sport the way that we used to, but wouldn't it be nice for Penske to just get on top of the podium and say, we won one the right way?
Mr. Peters.
I've got to be honest here. I'm kind of not looking forward to it this weekend. Kind of coming out of Talladega, it feels like we're going to, you know, what's going to be a less exciting race. And typically when I feel like this, it normally means that it's a good race. So I'm going to take some of Tom's natural enthusiasm towards this race this weekend and hope that it will be a good one. But again, not expecting anything amazing, but Tom, you're right. It can sometimes be a track where we do see good races, and you know, if we could see someone unexpected run up front, that would be even better. So perhaps after 157 races and not winning, Stenhouse goes back to back. We've seen stranger things, but not many.
Excellent. Well, you heard it from the best folks. Kansas Speedway, 7:30, Fox Sports 1 this weekend. Gentlemen, give us your Twitter handles, and then we'll sign this thing off. Tom? Oh, the mute button's killing him again.
NASCAR balls. I cannot believe it. Three strikes and you're out.
That's the perfect way to end this podcast off. Danny?
At Danny Peters, one last thing before I go. Good job to Stenhouse and Roush Fenway Racing for their first win in a very long time. When I looked up their last win and I had to look it up and realized it was Carl Edwards at Sonoma, you know it's been a long time. So congratulations to Jack Roush and that whole organization, and also that amazing quote by Ricky Stenhouse when he said he drove into victory lane and he saw Jack and Danica standing there together and they were the same size. I just thought that was a priceless comment. So sorry to do more than my Twitter handle, but I did just want to throw that little thing out there.
I'm glad that you said that, because you know what? Here's my parting shot. Danica Patrick and Ricky Stenhouse Jr., leave the poor people alone. You know, if your significant other won a race for the first time, wouldn't you be happy for them? I can't believe they made the cover – well, not the cover of People, but they were on People magazine this week. They were all over the place. who freaking cares? It's, you know, another couple that's happy for each other because one of the two accomplished something great. Yep.
Know that.
Yeah.
I agree entirely. Wouldn't you be happy if it was your other half? Absolutely. And that's exactly what Danica shows. And if anything, Danica knows just how hard it has been for Ricky to get to where he's got to. So, you know, I agree. Leave them alone. Let them enjoy their moment. Like, who hates love? Like, if you hate love, there's something wrong with you.
Yes.
Well, I love love. And I'm not necessarily a fan of People magazine, but if you're a NASCAR fan, go pick up a People magazine this week. Go check out Danica and Ricky apparently on the cover. I won't, but I know many will. So on that note, we'll catch you guys next week.